Consumer Affairs Committee and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 172. And Janet, can you give us a rundown, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 172 is at the request of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Was pre-session filed. It passed on the Senate voted 24-1. The bill changes the reconsideration date in workers' compensation claims for when the reconsideration period begins, and for an employer's or a self-insured employer or an insurer's reconsideration request. It also authorizes the director of DCBS to impose a civil penalty upon violation of certain statutes. This is not much of an expansion because they already have authority to impose civil penalties for violation of rules, so it's really just a clarification. And repeals an unused section of law, and that is copied for you at your place today for a 656-806. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Those changes are on page 4. And page 9. And page 11, right?
Yes.
Okay. What does the... clarification is what changing from later to earlier, what does that mean?
Well, that, Mr. Chair, John Schultz did a very nice job of explaining it to me again, so I think that
John? Good morning, John.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Schultz, administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear today to request committee support on SB 172. My written testimony is being passed around, but to address your specific question, When a worker's compensation claim is closed and a worker has permanent disability, they have a right to a benefit for that if they're permanently disabled from the injury. Either the worker or the insurer may appeal that finding. And in this particular case, what we're doing is when an insurer appeals the notice of closure, the current law basically says that we must hold action on that appeal until the later of three things occurs. Either the worker themselves request reconsideration also, so there's a cross request, the worker waives their right to reconsideration, or the time within which reconsideration can be requested expires. What this bill would do is move to the earliest of any of those three actions. The effect is that it would speed up the process of reconsideration. And if you look at the three things that are triggering, a worker requesting reconsideration, there's no reason to necessarily wait to start the reconsideration process than when both parties have requested, or if a worker waives their right to request reconsideration but the insurer wants reconsideration, again, there's no need to wait on that. And if the time has expired, well, that's the latest event that could occur. So what we're simply trying to do here is move from the latest of those events, which holds taking action on this appeal process, to the earliest of those events, which would speed up the reconsideration process. There would be no loss of rights for any party involved.
Okay, any questions, John? Don't see any questions. I guess I've got them all answered already. And then it repeals. This also repeals some statutes.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The bill does two other things. It basically repeals an existing statute that's frankly obsolete, and that's a statute that allows the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to select a physician for an employer who is requesting to do a pre-employment physical on a worker. We don't have any record over the last 20 years when anyone has requested that. Originally the law said that the director would make that selection off a list of physicians. The law that was to create the list was actually repealed back in the 1960s, so there's not even a list at this point in time. It seems to just be an artifact left over from an earlier time. This law has been on the books since 1943, but we couldn't find any time when it's ever been used, and we're recommending that it just be taken out of the statute. The last thing that this bill does, it grants authority to the director to issue civil penalties for a violation of a statute under the workers' compensation law. Currently, the director has authority, as Ms. Atkins indicated, to levy civil penalties for violations of rules, administrative rules, or orders of the director. But we don't have specific authority to issue a civil penalty for a violation of law. So the practical result of that is that in those areas where we're concerned that there would be violations of law that should result in civil penalties, is we replicate the law in our administrative rules, therefore giving us the ability to levy a civil penalty. It balloons out the administrative rules. It makes them larger than they ought to be. The effect of doing this would be to streamline the size of the administrative rule process. And Mr. Chair, I don't know of any opposition to this bill at this time.
Okay, thank you, John. Any questions? Don't see any.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 172? And I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 172 and open a work session on Senate Bill 172. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that I make a motion that we send Senate Bill 172 to the House floor with a due path recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves Senate Bill 172 to the floor with a due path recommendation. Is there any discussion? Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative
Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative
Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Cody.
Aye.
Representative Pitts.
Aye.
Representative
Hill.
Aye.
Representative
Steele.
Aye.
Motion carries. Representative Esquivel.
Mr. Chair, I recommend that we put that on the consent calendar.
Esquivel moves that we place Senate Bill 172 on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 386A, and Janet, please get us up to speed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the A engrossed version. You should have a Senate Bill 386. It makes a number of changes relating to permanent total disability claims and findings, and establishes a new process for rescinding permanent total disability status and workers' compensation claims. It also defines what constitutes gainful employment. Mr. Chair, there's a number of changes that the agency can explain, and this bill also has amendments that are being worked on by legislative council and are not available today, so this will probably be just constitute a hearing today.
Thank you, Janet. John, again. And could I have Jim Egan, too, at the same time, please? I would say that there's apparently something in this bill for Representative Kitts. It has a description of gainful employment in there.
Bet he's married yet, Mr. Chair.
Only one's for free.
Go ahead, John.
Mr. Chair, again, for the record, my name is John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, a part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I appear today to request the committee's support for Senate Bill 386A. This bill concerns permanent total disability claims, and those are serious claims, serious and expensive claims within the workers' compensation system, both in terms of economic impact, but also in terms of the human impact for workers and their families. Once a worker is determined permanently totally disabled, what that means is that as a result of their injury or occupational disease, they're no longer expected to be able to work in gainful and suitable employment as a result of their work-related injury. They get the compensation for that, wage replacement benefits, as well as their medical benefits for the injury-related condition. They get those benefits for life, and in fact, the wage replacement benefits can continue for their spouse after the death of the worker. But we're talking about actually a very few number of claims because we're really looking at very catastrophic injuries here, where a worker is unable to work at all. SB 386A proposes really to change two parts of the workers' compensation statute relating to permanent total disability. The first is to establish a threshold, which is to determine if a worker qualifies for permanent and total disability benefits. And right now, one of the issues that we're facing in workers' compensation is revolves around the definition of gainful employment. Gainful employment was really established, the current definition, in a court case, T versus Albertsons. And in that case, the court found that if a worker could regularly work at a minimum wage job, even if it's just a few hours a week, but they can regularly do that, then they would be considered gainfully employed and therefore not permanently totally disabled. The Management Labor Advisory Committee in the interim worked on this issue, put quite a few hours into it, and decided that that wasn't what they wanted to recommend that the law should do. 386 would redefine gainful occupation as one that pays a specific income level to the worker. In other words, the worker must be capable of regularly earning a certain income. And the earning level that the Management Labor Advisory Committee is recommending would be equivalent to the lesser of two options. One is the federal poverty level as established by the U.S. Health and Human Services for a family of three, which is currently just over $1,300 per month, or an amount equal to essentially two-thirds of the worker's average weekly wages at the time of injury, whichever is less. The reason that they went with both of those and not just one was because you have workers who are in a lot of different situations. You can have workers who are choosing to work just part-time. For example, a worker who may for many years have been choosing to work 15, 20 hours a week. They never earned $1,340 per month, so there would be a fallback to use the 66 2/3% of their average weekly wages. So the first part of 386 establishes really a threshold for workers. If they can earn more than those two thresholds, then they would be not considered permanently totally disabled. The second part of SB 386 addresses the process for rescinding permanent total disability benefits. Under current law, workers' compensation insurers are required to review the status of permanently totally disabled workers every 2 years. If the insurer or self-insured employer determines that the worker no longer qualifies for permanent total disability benefits, the insurer closes the worker's claim and terminates the permanent total disability benefits. In other words, the wage replacement benefits, the medical benefits would continue. The worker can appeal that decision, but the reality is that the appeal process can take several months, and the worker could find themselves in a situation where they're without income for 7, 8, 10 sometimes months or sometimes longer. What SB 386 proposes to do is several things in regard to the rescinding of permanent total disability benefits. First of all, it requires that the worker's vocational or medical condition is demonstrated to have materially improved. There must be some material improvement in the worker's condition. If a worker requests a hearing on the notice of closure, rescinding their permanent total disability benefits, the insurer or self-insured employer must continue to pay the wage replacement benefits throughout the appeal process. It allows the insurer or self-insured employer to be reimbursed for payment of those benefits if the insurer's position is upheld by the hearings division eventually. The bill also allows an administrative law judge in the Workers' Compensation Board to request a medical arbiter examine the worker. And what this means is that the worker can have an impartial examination from a physician who's selected by the Workers' Compensation Division. If there is an order that terminates the worker's wage replacement benefits, terminates their permanent total disability status, the bill basically makes the worker automatically eligible to receive vocational retraining. So there is a mechanism to help the worker get back to work. It also, the bill requires the worker to attend and cooperate with requested vocational examinations. The current law requires workers to cooperate with medical examinations, but there's never been anything in the law requiring them to cooperate with a vocational evaluation or examination. This bill would require workers to do so. The bill also allows permanently totally disabled workers to perform some work and earn modest wages, and this would be for the first time. Currently, a worker that's never been contemplated before. Once we set a wage threshold that was off the floor where we're sitting now, it contemplates that a worker can earn some money and a modest amount of money and work. All the parties to this decision seem to like that because there's an incentive there for a worker to go out and try to get back to work. The bill specifies that a worker who's receiving permanent and total disability benefits, if they are working and they suffer a new compensable workers' compensation claim, it specifies what benefits they're entitled to receive so that they don't get dual benefits. The benefits they would be entitled to receive would be just medical care for the condition from the new claim and any new permanent impairment that they suffer as a result of that claim. Finally, the bill specifies that if a worker is receiving permanent total disability benefits and they return to work, their benefits that they receive are prorated. And basically how that works is that the combination of the total of their wages plus their benefits may not exceed their pre-injury earnings. Once they do, then the benefits are reduced dollar for dollar. As Ms. Adkins indicated, there are amendments, they're technical amendments, that are currently being worked on by legislative counsel that address a couple more issues. And these amendments were recently recommended by the Workers' Compensation Management Labor Advisory Committee. They're intended to make the law work better. These amendments were identified after the bill came out of the Senate, and they include more of a definition of what does it mean to materially improve vocationally. We've had a definition for material improvement medically, but there's never been a vocational material improvement definition. There's a clarification of the requirement that a permanent total disability evaluation should include at least one interview or examination in person with the worker. For purposes of the gainful employment threshold that I talked about, there is a provision for a cost of living adjustment for workers' wages that are in those amendments. And there's also a clarification that the new provisions of the bill will apply to all new evaluations to determine a worker's permanent disability status, including reevaluation of workers who are currently permanently totally disabled. And those are the amendments that are in the pipeline and will probably be coming in front of this committee shortly. I'd be happy to answer any questions I can.
Representative Shoffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get on the record. I have to leave. I'm in the House Budget Committee at 8:30, but if winter world, these bills are all good stuff, and I didn't want anyone in the crowd thinking because my chair is empty that my work ethic is somehow weakening.
Okay. All right, sir. I'm out.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate that. Any other questions of John?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, I got a question about the medical examinations and the vocational examinations that you referred to as the worker cooperating with those. I've got some concerns over the amount of examinations that can be required of a worker, not just in this situation, but in all workman's comp claims. And can you tell me, is there a limit to the amount of examinations that the insurer or the department can require?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, currently in administrative rule, the insurer is allowed 3 independent or insurer medical examinations per opening of the claim. There is also a provision that they can approach the director if they have exhausted their 3 exams and request another under special circumstances or certain circumstances where it's clear that another examination would be needed. And an example of that would be that the worker's attending physician is closing the claim, but the worker's attending physician is saying, I'm not qualified to rate the impairment of the worker, and I'm requesting that another examination by, let's say, an orthopedist or something like that be done to actually rate the worker's impairment. And in those cases, we would allow for an additional examination.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you for that. I guess my concern around this is oftentimes we have cases where there's several different insurers involved in a particular claim, say 3 or 4 insurers, and maybe not so much in total disability, but I know in regular workman comp claims that workers are sometimes required to go to 9, 10, 11, 12 examinations, having to leave work if they are back at work sometimes when these claims are being adjudicated. And it seems that, you know, it becomes almost an unfair issue when a worker is, you know, forced to leave work, and it's unfair to the employer as well to do without that worker sometimes. I just would hope that our rules would sometime think of a limit on the amount of these examinations that take place. I mean, it seems like if the insurers, there's three or four, they could agree on, you know, three or four examinations, because it just gets absurd, I think, sometimes to continually go back to another examination until the insurer gets the result he wants. I just have a concern in that regard. Thank you.
May I respond, Mr.
Certainly.
Chair? Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, during the last interim, the Management Labor Advisory Committee did take up the issue of the IMEs, as they're known in the industry, or the independent or insurer medical examinations. And there is a bill that's winding its way through the process, SB 311, that does address some of the issues in regard to these examinations.
Thank you.
Any other questions of John? Thank you, John. Jim, I'd like to give your testimony, please.
Chairman Brown, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I am Jim Egan. I practice workers' compensation law in Albany. I have done that for the last 20 years. I have submitted to you written testimony, and I'd just like to say amen to everything Brother Schultz said today. And and maybe as he's kind of sketched the bill, I'll perhaps fill in some of the color. The workers have been denied meaningful benefits in terms of catastrophic injuries now for about 15 years. It's been terrible for injured workers for the last 10, since 1995. The Betty T. decision, T. versus Albertson, says basically that if you can work part-time at minimum wage, you're not permanently and totally disabled. And what that means is, in some cases, and there have been cases out there where people are literally bedridden, but they're offered jobs like telephone solicitation, which they can do at their own leisure, so that they cannot work meaningfully for more than an hour or so at a time, and they just, you know, make phone calls, and they're not permanently and totally disabled. This means that an injured worker who is a pipe fitter, a welder, an electrician, or a legal secretary, or any number of different occupations, becomes terribly disabled, and they can never receive any ongoing meaningful benefits. This bill corrects what I call Oregon's dirty little secret with regard to workers' compensation, and that is that permanent total disability, in effect, really doesn't exist in Oregon anymore. That could not be illustrated any more significantly than in the year 2001. I've done extensive research in 2001 with regard to the states that allowed permanent total disabilities. We call those catastrophic injuries versus deaths. In every other state in the union, save two, there were more deaths in every other state than there were more catastrophic injuries than there were deaths. And if you think about that, that kind of makes sense. When somebody gets hurt, we try to save their lives. And the first thing we do is we save their lives. And then perhaps there are catastrophic injuries kind of left over, the residue of those terrible injuries. In two states that I can identify, the deaths in the state exceeded the catastrophic injuries. Those states were Oregon, where a negative one permanent total disability was awarded. In other words, we took more permanent total disabilities away than we gave. And New York City, where 3,000 workers died in the World Trade Center on September the 11th. That's hideous. It's terrible. Now, it's terrible that 3,000 injured workers died in the World Trade Center, and it's terrible that in Oregon we did not recognize that permanent total disability should exceed the number of deaths in our state. What we've got is a bill now that corrects that problem, or at least begins to correct that problem. The bill proposes a standard that is basically the federal poverty standard for an award of permanent total disability. Right now, about $1,300 per month for a family. The bill creates a second standard that incorporates in the statute a standard for people who already make less than the federal guidelines. This second standard raises some serious concerns for us. We do not oppose, at Oregon Trial Lawyers, we do not oppose this bill, but we want to raise these concerns in this hearing. Our concerns include the desperate impact that the second or lower standard has on women and the working poor. I give specific examples in my written testimony about a teacher, and teachers, many teachers take their salary on a nine-month basis. They don't take a salary during the summertime. In this scenario, if a teacher were to take a salary on a nine-month basis and then work throughout the summer at a minimum wage job at Costco or at some other Walmart or something doing greeting and the like, but suffered a catastrophic injury at the end of the summer, then that teacher's wages would include the 3 months prior to the injury, minimum wage, and then 9 months of his salary, and it would have a tendency to diminish the value of his overall income. The point being, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, that in fact, from our perspective, from the perspective of the people that represent injured workers, we shouldn't value people differently. We shouldn't value workers differently. We need to value them the same. Nevertheless, this bill is a significant improvement in the standard for measuring gainful employment and the standard for measuring permanent and total disability, and therefore we give it our support at this particular point. There are other great provisions of the bill. The bill proposes a standard of review for permanent total disability awards that rescission of permanent total disability awards that makes it necessary for the insurer to show a change in the condition to take away permanent total disability. That is a great improvement over the current standard. The bill proposes that Workers' Compensation Board be authorized to give or to allow medical arbiters a truly independent examination. And I certainly appreciate Representative Holvey's comments, having represented injured workers for 20 years. I've seen the cases where 9, 10, 11 compelled medical examinations have taken place. In this particular situation, Chairman Brown, Representative Holvey accurately identified that, in fact, this is just going to be one issue, so there will only be three compelled medical examinations. But in other cases, it gets to be problematic. And from the perspective of injured workers, having the division assign a compelled medical examination is not a bad thing. It's a good thing for us. The bill proposes to make all workers eligible for vocational benefits whose permanent total disabilities have been rescinded. That is a great benefit to injured workers, and we applaud that. With regard to in-person interviews, it's an important concept for independent, for compelled examiners to actually see and talk to an injured worker. Those amendments will be looked at with a great deal of appreciation. Overall, folks, the Oregon Trial Lawyers applaud this bill, and we look forward to the changes that are going to take place. It's going to save a lot of people's lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim, for your testimony. Any questions? Representative Kitts.
Jim, I just wanted to thank you. As you'll recall, I sponsored similar legislation last session. It didn't go anywhere. It's a worthy cause. I'm glad to see this committee has taken it up, and I'm glad to see that it's moving forward. If there's anything that I can do with regards to the amendments as they come forward, please let me know. But again, I applaud your diligence for two consecutive legislative sessions. This is good legislation, and I would encourage the support of the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 386? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 386. And then, which one is Senator Nelson here for?
Oh, the beginning of the telecommunications.
Let's see. Which one's under it? Okay. I know. Okay. Full standard E just for a moment there. 119. Janet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 119 is also a pre-session filed by the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It would authorize the director to provide reemployment assistance from the Worker Benefit Fund to eligible injured workers and their employers. And the bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. You do have should have a fiscal impact statement at your place, and you should be looking at the A engrossed bill from the Senate. The Senate vote on this bill was 27-0, and that's what I have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. John?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, John Schultz, Administrator of the Workers' Compensation Division, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The purpose of this bill is to increase the use of return-to-work programs. The bill clarifies the department's authority to provide direct services to workers through the Preferred Worker Program and promotes the use of vocational assistance or retraining services. What we know in terms of doing research based on the return-to-work programs here in Oregon in, as part of the workers' compensation system is in looking at injured worker outcomes, 13 quarters, which is over 3 years, after the worker's injuries. Those workers who are eligible for and use these programs versus workers who are eligible for, excuse me, but do not use these programs. The workers who do use the programs go back to work at significantly higher rates, and they go back to work at significantly higher wages than those other workers. Most injured workers who have a permanent disability are not eligible for retraining. The threshold for eligibility for retraining is fairly high. If a worker in Oregon has the knowledge, skill, and ability to do jobs that are available in their communities, and those jobs, if they pay 80% of the wage that they were making at the time of injury, the worker's not eligible for those retraining services. The number of workers we're talking about for retraining through workers' compensation here in Oregon, since 1998, the numbers of workers eligible for retraining have fluctuated from about 700 to about 770 workers per year. In terms of the Preferred Worker Program, which is a program that workers who have permanent disabilities unable to go back to their regular job, they become eligible for that program. We're looking at over 2,000 workers per year who are eligible for that program. The Preferred Worker Program is funded by both employer and worker assessments, contributions to the Worker Benefit Fund. The Preferred Worker Program provides incentives to employers in order to hire injured workers. Some of those incentives include exemptions from having to pay workers' compensation premiums for 3 years on an injured worker, providing wage subsidies up to 50% of the wages for 6 months for the worker, providing tools, training, work site modifications where we actually go in and re-engineer a work site and we'll do so up to normally up to $25,000 in re-engineering of the work site. So the Preferred Worker Program provides what I consider to be very significant benefits to employers when they want to hire a permanently disabled worker. Now, based on surveys that we've done with workers, they basically tell us that there's a couple of things that would help them use the Preferred Worker Program more. And what those are help finding a job and help deciding what type of work to pursue. What the preferred worker program, how the preferred worker program works is that the worker gets a card and they essentially go out and sell themselves on the open labor market to employers. And they also sell the program incentives. The worker is pretty much out on their own when they're doing this. The Management Labor Advisory Committee in the interim looked at this issue as well and really looked at what can we do to get workers back to work after they've had a permanently disabling injury. The division had already done the study, asking workers for their input. And the Management Labor Advisory Committee came back and made a recommendation that one of the most important things we could do would be to offer services to injured workers, directly to injured workers, to help them find employers. In other words, to begin to provide workers with the skills to do job search and to sell themselves to employers. This bill provides very plainly in the law that we can do this. We talked to the Department of Justice because, frankly, the current statutory language may or may not allow for that. The Department of Justice advised us that we make the meaning of the statute plain, that such assistance must or can be provided through the Preferred Worker Program. We also provide workers with direct purchases to assist them when they have landed a job with an employer, for example, appropriate office attire. You have a worker who maybe has worked as a mechanic, and the employer is willing to bring them back to work under the Preferred Worker Program, but they want to do have the worker work as an estimator. The worker may not possess appropriate office attire, and we would provide that sort of attire to the worker to get them going in their employment. Again, the Department of Justice's advice to us was clarify the language in the statute and make it very plain that you have the authority to do so. So one part of this bill is to just make language plain that we can provide assistance directly to workers through the Preferred Worker Program to get them back to work. Passage of this bill, by the way, in terms of the Preferred Worker Program, won't result in more injured workers being eligible for the program, but it will increase the percentage of workers who use it to achieve gainful employment. The second part of this bill is in relation to the retraining program that I spoke of earlier. When an insurer determines that an injured worker is not eligible for vocational assistance or vocational retraining, the worker has the right to appeal that decision. That goes to an administrative review at the department. If the administrative review overturns the insurer's decision, in other words, the administrative review says, yes, the worker should be eligible for vocational assistance, the insurer may appeal that decision. The way the law works currently is that the vocational assistance benefits that the worker may be eligible for are stayed or held while those appeals are being sorted out. The stay of benefits can last for several months, sometimes 7, 8, 9, 10 months can go by while the appeal process takes place. For a worker who does not have a job and is waiting to go into a retraining program because they don't have the skills to obtain a job that pays them at 80% of the wage that they were making at the time of injury, this can cause financial hardship for the worker. So it was the recommendation of the Management Labor Advisory Committee that this bill allow vocational assistance to proceed pending the insurer's appeal or appeals. In other words, even if the insurer appeals the finding of the department that the worker is eligible, the worker can proceed working with the counselor to get a vocational assistance plan together, and that retraining plan can start so that the worker can get on their way towards retraining. Now, if the department's decision is overturned at some later point in the appeal process, the costs of that vocational assistance already provided to the worker would be reimbursed to the insurer from the worker's benefit fund as part of this bill. And just to let you know how often that occurs, over the last 3 years, there have only been four decisions by the department that have been overturned on appeal. So we're not expecting that to change, nor do we expect that there's going to be a lot of decisions overturned. So essentially, that's what this bill does.
Thank you, John. Any questions? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, John, in this bill, we're allowing job placement services to happen for workers in this preferred worker program. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, yes, this bill would allow for that. And the plan is to... Actually, we've been talking to the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services at DHS. Rather than duplicate a program that already exists, they work with disabled individuals and provide this type of assistance. We thought that we would work with them and try a pilot program and see how that works. In terms of working with injured workers, they indicated that they would be willing to set up a special unit that is skilled at working with injured workers to try to focus in on the needs of those workers who are somewhat different than their other clientele. We're not talking about people here who are mentally ill or developmentally disabled. You've got mainly musculoskeletal orthopedic disabilities here. So there'd be a unit to work with them. And we have been talking about doing a two-year pilot to assess whether or not that this works before pushing forward and saying we have a program.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure that you were working in with the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, yes. We thought that was better than to try to replicate services that already exist out there.
Good. Thank you.
Any other questions, Representative Holley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John, do you have any idea what the cost per worker placed is with this program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I do have some information here. If you'd bear with me, I'll scan quickly. Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, the figures from the proposal that was jointly developed with the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services were that... In the pilot program, that we're looking at probably a cost of just over $3,000 per eligible worker in terms of working with that with those workers and placing them. Did I answer your question, Representative? Was that the question you were asking?
Yes, it was. Thank you.
Any other questions, Representative Kitts?
Mr. Chair, I just point out for the record, in relation to the Jobs Plus bill that we heard the other day, this program is over $600 more per worker place by comparison. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions from John? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony, John. Appreciate
thank
that.
You, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate your patience with me this morning.
Thank you. Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 119? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 119 and open a work session on Senate Bill 119. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill, or I would move to rescind the motion on the Ways and Means Committee and re-refer Senate Bill 119 to the House Budget Committee.
Representative Kitts moves the referral to Ways and Means be rescinded and the Senate Bill 119 be sent to the Committee on Budgets. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's done. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate Bill 119 to the Committee on House Budget.
Representative Kitts moves Senate. Okay. Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 119 to the Committee on Budgets with a do pass recommendation.
I would have said no recommendation, but if the committee's desire is a do pass recommendation, then I'm fine with that. I think it's up to the Ways and Means Committee to evaluate whether or not they can afford it, but whatever the chair wants.
Representative Holby.
I would agree with Representative Kitts at this point, not really having a good handle on the cost and the effectiveness of this program. I think the Budget Committee really needs to look at it with an open mind.
Thank you, Representative. The motion is to refer Senate Bill 119 to the Committee on Budgets without recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative
Kitts. Aye.
Excuse.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Aye. Motion carries. Okay. This one, huh? I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 353. Janet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 353 would make additions to the disclosure statement that's required in instruments that transfer title to real property, giving them notice that the property may be subject to claims for compensation or neighboring property may be subject to claims for compensation under Measure 37. And the bill actually is just the revised statement. So if you look at the A and Gross bill, the bolded language relates to those disclosures.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Harlan Levy, please?
Are you okay with this?
I don't understand.
Good morning, Harlan.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I am Harlan Levy, Senior Staff Attorney with the Oregon Association of Realtors. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. This is the first time that I have testified in front of this committee, and I really do appreciate this opportunity. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 353. This is a bill that we asked the Senate Environment and Land Use Committee to introduce early in the session. What it does is it amends the disclosure statement that is already required in all deeds and earnest money agreements. That is a statutory requirement that has existed since 1983 when the legislature created it in statute. It's been changed four times over the years as conditions have changed in land use laws, and we think it is appropriate for this legislature to add this additional language now that we have ballot measure 37 on the books. This particular language that we are requesting that you add into the disclosure advises the parties that Measure 37 exists. We worked on this language with Director Shetterly from the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and we wanted the language to not, we wanted it to be as neutral as possible, just to spot the issue for both buyers and sellers to let them know that this could potentially affect their property. If they're a seller, they might be losing some rights that they may have had, and if they're a buyer, it may affect, ballot measure 37 may affect some of the rights that their neighbors may have. So this is just a consumer protection bill where we think all parties ought to be informed of the existence of this, and that it should be up to them to inquire if they want further information about what Measure 37 may do to this particular transaction. Currently, the disclosure speaks to such issues as the difficulty in developing rural lands, the potential for a property to not be located in a fire protection district, as well as the potential that properties might be subject to right-to-farm laws that could limit some of the potential nuisance lawsuits that a landowner might seek to file. So there is precedent for this type of disclosure in the law. Again, this bill is a consumer protection bill. It protects both buyers and sellers. It passed the Senate unanimously, 27-0. We are not offering any amendments, so we would respectfully request that you move this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. With that, I conclude my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Harlan. Any questions, Representative Estrella?
Yes, I just want to clarify that when you talk about a disclosure statement, I don't want anyone to get confused on this. It's not a property disclosure statement. It's a disclosure in the deed. This verbiage will go in the deed when you sign off on this, so therefore you have a red flag built right into your deed when it's recorded. So it's not a disclosure statement and has nothing to do with the property disclosure, but it does have to do with the deed itself.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Esquivel, thank you for that explanation. You are correct. This is the statutory warning that exists in the deed as well as in earnest money agreements. It is not the document that we refer to as the seller's disclosure statement, which is an additional document that is statutory required. This is not going in there. This is going into the deed and the earnest money. Thank you for that explanation.
Representative Kitts.
I would just like to thank Representative Esquivel for that clarification, and I now better understand the bill thanks to that clarification. So
anytime.
I appreciate erasing that confusion that I once had.
Thank you. Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you for your testimony this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 353? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 353 and open a work session on Senate Bill 353. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate Bill 353 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 353 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll?
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Schaffler.
Excused.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Gellin. Aye. Chair Branch. Aye. Motion carried. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move that Representative Esquivel, with his wonderful ability to articulate this bill, carry it on the floor.
Is this like in the service when they say, if you want to volunteer, step forward, and everybody else steps back?
That's it. You got the right picture.
Yeah, okay.
Representative Esquivel will carry the bill on the floor for us. Thank you, Representative. Let's
Thank
see.
You, Representative Kitts.
Anytime.
And, committee, we warned Janet out, and she's going to pack up and leave. And Kara Fisher is stepping in to take over, and so be on your best behavior, please.
Yes, sir.
Who are you talking to there?
He's talking to you.
I was looking down this way.
Oh.
On pass.
I thought it was me.
Okay, I open the public hearing on Senate Bill 13. And Kara, can you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 13, you have the A and Gross version before you, was introduced pre-session and brought forward by the Committee on Information Management and Technology for the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council. The measure requires the Public Utilities Commission to biennially submit a report to the governor and the legislature or the emergency board on or before January 31st of odd number years that lists the status of competition and regulation in the telecommunications industry. The report also requires that it hold data regarding the availability of broadband broadband services and the usage of broadband service, and the state and states that the commission, the bill also states that the commission may impose reporting requirements on telecommunication utilities for the purpose of implementing information regarding broadband service. There is an emergency clause on the bill. It did pass the Senate 29-0, and I think as we can point out the value of the bill by the fact that one of the people signed up to testify on the bill today is with you via video conferencing.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitt.
For clarification, it says, and states the commission may not impose reporting requirements.
Thank you, Representative Kitt. That's right. May not. I missed it.
Thank you, Representative.
I don't want to be nice. Mr. Tangle.
And is Ed Parker on the air now?
I believe so, Mr. Parker. Can you hear us?
Mr. Parker, can you hear us? He's talking. His lips are moving, but I don't hear anything.
We don't hear him.
Regarding that problem with broadband that we were having.
Thank you, Senator, for your patience. Do you operate this way in the Senate?
Exactly. I'm just happy to be here.
Their lips move, but you can't hear what they say?
Absolutely.
Or their lips move, and you don't want to hear what
they say. Perhaps what works is that you may wish to hear from Senator Nelson.
Okay. But Senator, why don't you go ahead and thank you for your patience this morning with us.
No problem. It's kind of nice just being here. For the record, my name is David Nelson. I'm state senator from Pendleton. I represent Senate District 29, which is four counties in eastern Oregon, northeast Oregon. It's Morrow, Umatilla, Union, and Wallowa counties. It's 250 miles from one end to one end and 150 the other way, so it's quite a distance out there. I'm here today to testify on Senate Bill 13 and also Senate Bill 15 and Senate Bill 17. I don't know if I could give kind of coordinated testimony on.
Why don't we go ahead? I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 15 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 17.
Okay, there's some differentiation between the three bills. During the interim, I chaired the interim committee on technology, and we sent out a series of bills. It was Senate Bill, I think, 11 through 16. And you have before you today Senate Bills 13 and 15. Through the process, these are the two bills that have survived coming through the Senate. Senate Bill 17 is actually a request that was made to me through the PUC that we would study the statutes of telecommunications and see if we couldn't coordinate those a little bit. But I would direct my attention first to Senate Bills 13 and 15 and talk more kind of on a global picture of where this is all coming from. These bills coming to you as a basic coordinated effort that started actually in 1999 and probably even before that, if you talk with Gary Wilhelms in the Speaker's office when he was back lobbying for U.S. West. They were trying to always improve the telecommunications. But for some reason, the stars came together in 1999, and we passed out Senate Bill 622. That was the creation of the broadband network that we have in the state of Oregon, which is probably a state of the art in the nation, if not in the world. You think of it like Olympic rings. There's five of them. They're interconnected, they're redundant, so if it's broken one place, it automatically goes the other way. High speed, high bandwidth. One of the true success stories in the state of Oregon. Its importance is that bill basically came out of a group of grassroots people in La Grande, Oregon, in my district. They had three fiber optic cables running through the city of La Grande. There's no off-ramps. They could see they were getting left behind. So somehow they got together with U.S. West at that particular time and said, okay, look, we have to solve this problem, but there's no money to do it. So they came up with this agreement basically in exchange for a regulatory reform from a rate of return to a price cap regulation to change. U.S. West would come up with $120 million, and then we would build this fiber optic network. Well, that's what happened. And in 1999, it was quite an amazing process. I happened to be chairing that committee at that time also, and those are the good old days. we had, you know, 50 to 60 people involved. We had telcos, we had consumer groups, we had grassroots people. And the important thing with Senate Bills 13 and 15, basically, these bills are coming out of that grassroots people, the people that actually started Senate Bill 622 and got things moving and really made the difference in getting this whole system built, are still together, and they're in the form now called this Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council. And that's under Senate Bill 15, which is an extension. They would be sunsetted this year. And they want to be extended. I think now it's out to 2010. I believe that's the bill. I'd have to look at that again. But we're kind of in a similar situation because we have some of the telcos that think, well, they ought to go away now. But if we'd have listened to the telcos back in 1999, except for U.S. West, we wouldn't have this telecommunication infrastructure that we have. I mean, there's some progress being made there. And in fact, the vote in the Senate, I think, was 17-13 for Senate Bill 629 back in those days. Because it's, you know, people have strong feelings about this thing. But this group, this Oregon Telecommunications Council, and I think Ed Parker is involved in this thing too. He's one of the Coast representatives. And if you look at the statute, there's a whole group of people. And that came out of May of a bill in the last session, 2755 out of the House, which actually created them with a mission to advise and to help expand the opportunities for access for Oregonians. These folks aren't getting paid under Senate Bill 15. It does have a thing in there is that if they find some grants, they can get some per diem. But these folks are basically volunteering their time. And so what I'm looking at it is they are pushing the consumer's outlook. They sometimes agree with the telcos, sometimes they disagree. They always invite the telcos into their committee meetings. They always have hearings, and they're very inclusive. They're very active, and most of them are very bright people. And what their sole thing is to create access for Oregonians. So it's a very good group, and you're going to probably have the telcos come in and testify against them. But I mean, take that with a grain of salt. And here's a group of volunteers, Oregonians, are out trying to do the best thing for the state of Oregon. You know, access for people. They're successful. They've done it. In the last interim, they were involved in a group with health care. What they were finding, they had all this telecommunication capability, but hospitals and nurses and doctors and were not educating or not coordinating between the silos. And so they got this interim group together, and they have created a group that has, with Oregon Health Science University, with all these members, it's urban, it's rural, it's improved access to health care in the state of Oregon. So, I mean, they're doing some really good things. And so, I mean, I'm very supportive in wanting to do that. And when the telcos come up and say, well, you know, these guys are just a pain in our neck, get rid of them, I mean, I hope you don't listen to that, because these people are doing a good job. They're Republicans, they're Democrats, urban, they're rural. They do lots of things. So, that's kind of the overall view. You can tell I have a little passion for these folks. And I know there's some folks in the back here that are going to talk about that, talk about the details of the bill, so I won't get involved in talking about that. I just, you know, the Senate Bill 15, I think, is a very crucial bill because that keeps this group going, gives them some impetus. And actually what they're working on in this interim is how do you do the same thing with workforce as they did with the medicine. How do you create this connectivity and break down these silos so that we actually have some continuity? And there might be hearing a bill, I think it's Senate Bill 882 that we just passed out of the Senate, that creates a working group with public-private. You've got the Employment Department assessing the needs in the state of Oregon for health care. Well, they're working with this Oregon Telecommunications Council. So, I mean, this is a good group. These are people that are doing some positive things. So I'll get off that, off my high horse with that one. But I feel very strongly about Senate Bills 13 and 15, and I know people will testify to them.
Senator, if I could just interrupt you a minute then. Senate Bill 13 requires the report. Senate Bill 15 extends the sunset.
Keeps the group going.
All right.
And from my view, that is the most important bill because they are doing some really good things. Senate Bill 17 came about because I talked with the chair of the PUC, Lee Beyer, and talking about telecommunications, and he's in the back of the room, and he'll testify to more of that. But basically, Oregon's telecommunications laws are a hodgepodge of laws that started back when everything was a monopoly, when we just had a monopoly. With all the changes that are going on, in talking with him, we felt that we needed to have something to look at. We needed to have a task force or a group to sit down, be in their interim, because it's a very complicated issue, and work through this. The other issue there is that also the Federal Communications, has a say in what's going on here, and there's some confusion what's going on at the federal level. And I think that the commissioner will probably tell you that they would like some time to see exactly where the feds are going with this. But the difference between 17 and 15 is the fact that this is just looking at statutory things, statutory changes in 17. 15 is a group of people that are out there basically trying to bring access to the state of Oregon. So with that, I'll let some people that actually know what they're talking about back here do that. And I'll answer any questions if anybody can.
Representative Katz.
Senator, thank you. I appreciate your passion on the issue. Quick question. I'm looking at the on House Bill, or excuse me, Senate Bill 13, the testimony of Mr. Parker, as I'm sure he'll read. But basically, he's saying the bill extends the sunset on 13 from June 30th of 05 to January 2nd of 08. Am I correct so far?
Yeah, that's the PUC reporting obligations.
For Senate Bill 13. And then on Senate Bill 15, it extends the sunset on OTCC all the way out until January 2nd of 2010. Why the difference in the sunsets?
Well, the Senate Bill 13 is a reporting requirement,
mm-hmm.
and Senate Bill 17 is extending the life of the committee, thinking that, well, five years, that, will their work be done at that particular time? I think they're just two different areas, and maybe some of the folks that were involved in coming up with the language of statute can give you a better explanation. But
okay. I'll ask the same question.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Nelson. I just wanted to put on the record that part about possible contributions coming from the outside to the council, I just wanted to put on the record that it would be a shame if the neutrality of the council might someday be jeopardized because a party that had an interest made a big grant to the council.
Yeah, well, that is a good point. The other side of that is that Mr. Chair and Representative Shields, the other part of that is these folks are spending $1,000-$2,000 a year going to these meetings, doing things like that. I mean, it's a pretty substantial financial sacrifice for them, but they feel so passionate about it, they want to stay involved in it.
Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I for one understand the passion of doing something for virtually no pay, and I'm also under the impression that these folks were to receive a per diem. It wouldn't taint their opinion on anything. It'd just be simply a per diem. So I would state that for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Senator. Appreciate your testimony.
Where are you going with that?
You know where I was going with that.
One per diem is okay, too. I don't know.
To do one job and be paid for is okay, but to do two jobs and be paid for one is okay also.
Is Ed Parker?
We're checking with that guy.
Ed, can you hear us now? No.
We can't hear Ed.
No. Still not working, huh? Is this part of the system that they're going to be working on here? Oh, he can hear us?
We'll have to ask Ed what carrier he has when he gets on.
Nod.
Anyway, we have Ed's written testimony. The committee has been distributed to you.
We could ask him yes or no questions.
Yeah. And I think it needs to be pointed out that Ed is a constituent of mine in down in my district and lives in Glen Eden Beach and has been very, very active in the telecommunication areas there. And it's obvious we need his services down there.
Mr. Chair, this is Kathy Britton. Looks like we have the same problem. She can hear us, but we can't.
And Kathy's from where?
Medford.
Medford. Still no.
Yeah, the commission's working on this. Do you want to?
Okay.
Another couple other questions.
Never mind. Okay. To testify on Senate Bill 15, we have Rob Myers and Chris Tamron. Rob and Chris.
Do we ask Kathy to send us something, something that she wants to discuss?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christopher Tamron, and I'm with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today on behalf of the department to support Senate Bill 15 to extend the life of the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council. I have provided written copies of my testimony to the committee. For a little background, the council was created by the 2001 Oregon Legislature to study alternative approaches to providing statewide, regional, and local telecom services, including providing services to unserved and underserved areas of the state, and to study the manner in which telecommunications investment can be coordinated to facilitate partnerships between the public sector and the private sector and between state and local governments. As was mentioned, the council is unfunded, and its members volunteer their time and pay their own expenses because they believe telecommunications issues are critical to their communities and to the state. The Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council has been active over the past 3 years, providing a forum for the exchange of ideas and contributing directly to the establishment of public policy in this area in Oregon. Regarding broadband communications, we have established policy today as a result of House Bill 2577 introduced by the Council in 2003. It is now the goal of this state to promote access to broadband services for all Oregonians in order to improve the economy in Oregon, improve the quality of life in Oregon communities, and reduce the economic gap between Oregon communities that have access to broadband digital applications and services and those who do not. Regarding public safety, it is now public policy as a result of House Bill 2304 introduced by the Council in 2003. It's now the policy of the State of Oregon to encourage and support the rapid deployment of broadband telecommunication services in areas of the state where such services do not exist, to support redundancy of critical telecommunications assets in order to ensure homeland security protections in the state, and to ensure that a secure conduit is available for emergency communications and public safety networks in all Oregon communities. Regarding telemedicine, as a result of a policy recommendation by the Council in 2003, House Joint Resolution 4 was established, established a state position encouraging and supporting telemedicine reimbursement. The details of that resolution are included in my written testimony. This policy position on telemedicine now by the state on telemedicine reimbursement supports the use of information and telecommunications technologies to help meet healthcare needs in the state. In addition to this work, the Council has submitted multiple position papers and reports with other legislative concepts and policy recommendations. I invite the committee to visit the Council's website at www.ortcc.org to see the significant output of this group and to appreciate the time and effort the members of the Council have contributed to date. As to the intent and impacts of this bill, Senate Bill 15, it extends the life of the Council from January 2, 2006 to January 2, 2010, and it allows the Council members to be reimbursed for expenses if funds become available. Current law prohibits any compensation or reimbursement of expenses from any source. The Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council has been an asset and a contributor to the state, and I think the state will benefit from its continued existence. Thank you for your time this morning, and I'll try and answer any questions.
Thank you, Chris. Any questions? I don't see any. So, Rob, you want to give your testimony, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Myers. Thank you for the opportunity of speaking with you today. Actually, Mr. Tamarin covered about 95% of what I have in my testimony. So in the interest of saving time, I'll just simply say that I support the continuation of the council. I've been involved in it almost since its inception. It's important to understand as well that representation on the council includes rural people, urban people, various communities of interest, the telephone companies, K-12, higher education, community colleges, the tribes, most everyone who's involved in one way or another, either directly or peripherally in the telecommunications business of the state of Oregon. So again, Mr. Tamarin did a great job testifying, and I stand behind everything he said, and I encourage you to support Senate Bill 15. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Michelle. I'll ask my same question that I posed of Senator Nelson earlier. In Senate Bill 13, it talks about the sunset going until January 08. This would extend the sunset to January of 2010. One is the requirement of the PUC to submit the report and all of the aforementioned items that it should consist of. I don't need to go into that. You know what it says. Why the difference? I'll give you the premise behind my question so I'm not ambushing you. I get a little nervous sunsetting something out so far. I think you're taking it out three legislative sessions, essentially. Most of us will be gone. The average tenure is about three terms, if you can sweat it out that long. That being said, you then come back to a legislature when having something sunsetted. You need the reauthorization at that point. Nobody on the committee sits here and has a clue what they're reauthorizing because it's been something, and it hasn't been in the previous reauthorization. It didn't take it out that far. So could you explain why the requirement to report to the commission stops before the sunset does? And part two, why the sunset until 2010?
Sure. Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, I'll attempt to respond to that. The two bills really deal with two separate issues. The reporting requirement from the Oregon Public Utility Commission was a recommendation of the council, recognizing that the reports that the Public Utility Commission has been producing were useful to have to track improvement of broadband access and the status of competition within telecommunications in the state of Oregon. The Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council itself has no role in producing that report, but is a welcome receiver of the report and the information that it provides. So there's no connection between that report per se or the process of producing it and the Telecommunications Coordinating Council itself. So I guess the council didn't recognize necessarily a need to have a coterminous date for the two bills.
Coterminous. I will use that word at some point in time this week. May I follow up?
Follow up.
So my understanding then, if this report is necessary of the council to outline these things, and I don't need to read all of the necessary requirements of this report, am I to understand that currently that from the inception until now, you have no idea of the effectiveness that a report's necessary?
Chair Brown and Representative Kitts, I think the council is made up from representatives around the state, and council members themselves report on the effectiveness of increased broadband access in their own communities and around the state. There are reports that come out of the Federal Communications Commission and other sources of information. I believe the council's position is that more official sources of information and documentation are useful, and again, perhaps it would be useful to have that report beyond 2008. I don't know where that particular date came from with regard to the Oregon PUC report.
One final follow up, if I might.
Follow up.
The other concern that I have is the Universal Service Fund was set up for phones, to provide phones for folks in rural parts of our state. It seems like we're broadening the ability in these bills to use that fund for something other than phone lines. Now, I understand that broadband and these other things are wonderful ideas, but is it my it's my interpretation that that is not what that fund, and Senator Nelson did a good job of speaking to the creation of this fund and so on and so forth, was set up for. And I get nervous that we're, it reminds me of the 911 fee on cell phones and always trying to rob that fee. You know, you set up this pool of money, and then it's, you have just that, a pool of money, and there's always wonderful uses for money in this building, whether it's standing for the children or it's something other than that. But is my understanding of what the original intent of the USF fund was set up for was, in fact, for telecommunications, dial tones.
Chair Brown and Representative Kitten, I agree with you fully. The Oregon Universal Service Fund, as it currently stands, is specifically for basic service, dial tone services, and no others, no broadband services or any others are provided for under the Universal Service Fund statute. The two bills that we're talking about here, one the extension of the report generation from the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and two, the extension of the sunset date on the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council, neither of those bills address anything with regarding the Universal Service Fund.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. You know, before I was a legislator, I was active in my community as on city council, and I know time may move slowly or fast here, and sometimes use money where somebody might not want us to, but I'll tell you this much right now. 5 years when you're planning, especially in industry or development in a community, is not that long. So I think you all need time to plan and project out and look into the future and assess what you have and what you can do with it. And if you chop it up into 2 years, and there's no guarantee anything you bring back into this building every 2 years is vulnerable, and we all know that. So I think, in fairness out here, especially out in the rural areas where they really have to look for every opportunity they possibly can, 5 years is not really that long, especially when you're talking about industry, development, construction, communication, things like that. I just wanted to throw that.
I think the establishing sunsets out there, whether it's 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, 8 years, are always subject to the next session of the legislature. Sure. And no better example than what took place with the QBS legislature. That's another issue. Yeah, right. Any other questions of the panel? I don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. The committee is going to stand by for 2 minutes while we fix the audio problem, which is on our end.
Oh.
And with that, we'll stand by just here a couple minutes.
Where's this transmitting from? Where's this?
Kathy, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Hey!
I can hear you.
The wonders of modern communication. We apologize, but the problem was at our end, and I think we have it solved now.
Great. Are you able to hear Dr. Parker?
Can you hear me now?
Good morning, Ed. How's things down on the coast? Uh-oh, we lost him.
A little bit of blue sky and
some sunshine to peek through.
What happened to that big storm they said was coming?
It must have passed through in the night when we weren't watching.
Okay. Well, the committee's standing in these for a moment. As soon as we can get them back in here, we'll give it another try.
I tried to leave.
Reconvene the committee, and Kathy, we are taking testimony on Senate Bill 13, Senate Bill 15, and Senate Bill 17. I see you're signed up to testify on Senate Bill 13. If you'd like to go ahead and give your testimony now, and again, we apologize for our problems here.
Actually, Dr. Parker is going to present the testimony on 13. I will back clean up on 17 and represent the legislative committee point of view from the council. So I'll defer to Dr. Parker at this point.
Good. Thank you, Kathy. Ed, how do we get... Kenny?
Ed? Chair, members of the committee.
All right, I'm going to phone.
I'm very pleased to be with you this morning. Thank you for fixing the audio. I hope you can hear me now. You have my written testimony. I won't repeat it. Much of it's already been said before. The language in Senate Bill 13 was discussed in detail with the PUC and with some representatives of the industry. And the resulting language, including the date of 2008, was the consensus of those discussions amongst the three groups of people. And that's actually different from the Senate Bill 15, which extends the life of the council. And I request your support of Senate Bill 13 and ask you to send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I thank you for the opportunity to be here with you this morning, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if I can.
Thank you, Ed. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you again for your testimony, and stand by, and we'll move on and take some testimony on Senate Bill 17. And could I have Jenny Lang and Lee Beyer, please? What happened to Jenny? One out of two is not bad.
One out of two is not bad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Lee Beyer, chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, and it sounds like you're taking the three bills together. And I think
we are. Yeah, you want
so I can just if I could, Mr. Chair, I'll just kind of run through them. The
okay.
Commission supports all three of these bills. Senate Bill 13, essentially, from our perspective, does a couple of things. It extends the reporting deadline, as Representative Kitts was addressing earlier, until 2008, and Representative, I have no idea where that date came from. So I can't help you. We've kind of viewed this as an annual report. In our business, it's helpful to us, and in our charge, we perceive it as providing the Assembly and the Executive with information on where the industry is. Obviously, most of ours is focused on the traditional telephony, but there's considerable interest in broadband. While we do not regulate broadband services, that's restricted to the Federal Communications Commission, we have had good participation from the industry and all the players in trying to help Oregonians and particularly the legislature understand where that's at, and this would include in the report. More specifically, as we've looked at this, in 99, when we passed Senate Bill 6622, Senator Nelson and I were the chief sponsors on that on the Senate side. we went to this sort of more frequent report of annual. That's probably more than you need, since you only meet biannually, and this will get us back into a position of a more cost-effective kind of reporting structure. So we support that for that basis. And I guess I would, if the committee in the House chooses to adopt this, just I would ask that you keep in mind that it's ambitious in terms of how much detail I think particularly the council wanted in broadband, and we'll only be able to provide as much as we can get voluntarily from the industry. And again, I don't look at that being a big problem, but it could be. Senate Bill 15 talks about the sunset on the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council. We found over the few years that I've been on the commission that the council is helpful in being provocative and making us all think. And sometimes you may hear from the industry that they just assume not be having to deal with that. But I think they've done good work, and the commission supports extending that. Senate Bill 17 really talks to taking a look at the telecommunications industry and the policies embedded in statute during this interim. And I think that's important. It establishes a pretty good commission mix of legislators from both chambers, as well as six members at large appointed by the governor. The important thing, I think, for you to know is that our statutes, the last time the PUC statutes on telecommunications were reviewed were back in the late 60s. So it's been a long time, and none of us would doubt that the industry has changed a lot. One of the things that I've noticed on my time on the commission is that the terminology doesn't always fit anymore. It's constrained a little bit. You'll hear a bill a little later today in Senate Bill 600, where we tried to do some fixing and lining of the language, but we intentionally chose not to deal with some of the policy questions. Those are really important questions as the technology has changed in the business, and it's really important in terms of the changes in federal direction and state direction in terms of our communications policy. It's just time to take a look at that, and we think a task force makes sense in the calm of an interim to take a look at that and provide the legislature with the best advice we can as you come into session and the 07 session. So, Mr. Chair, that's very quick, and that's all I have to say.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Gibbs.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for your patience. I've got my bills lined out so I can look at all them at the exact same time, very meticulously. Representative Shoffler, don't mess them up.
I can look at
them, too. Look at my secret notes. The previous testifier, Mr. Tamron, I hope I'm saying that correctly,
yes,
stated to me, for the record, that none of these bills dealt with the Universal Service Fund. And I would take just a bit of issue with that, and if you'd like to come back forward.
I'm referring to Senate Bill 13 and Senate Bill 15.
Okay, so you agree that Senate Bill 17 does deal with the USF?
It does not.
Sorry, Mr. Chair.
For the record.
I thought they were going to be up when we came back from the recess.
Excuse me, I've been asked to return to the microphone again. My name is Christopher Tamron with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. Chair Brown and Representative Kitts, again, the two bills that I was, well, the one bill I was testifying on was Senate Bill 15, extends the life of the council. Senate Bill 13 extends the reporting requirement of the PUC. And those were the only two bills I was referring to, and neither of those bills in any way addresses the Universal Service Fund.
Okay. We had a follow-up. We have the public hearing that we're holding right now is on Senate Bills 13, 15, and 17 together. And so my concern, if you read Senate Bill 17, it says Senate Bill 17A is one of a series of legislative concepts developed by the Oregon Telecommunications Coordinating Council, ORTCC. OTRCC was created by the 2001 Oregon Legislature, Senate Bill 765, to provide all Oregonians with affordable access to broadband digital applications that will improve the quality of life in Oregon communities and reduce the economic gap between well-served and underserved Oregon communities for present and future generations. Right?
Mm-hmm.
How does the ORTCC propose to pay for that?
Well, Representative Brown and Representative Kitts, the ORTCC is a presents itself as a forum for discussion of ideas to do that and proposals to do that. So the council, as it collects input and information from its members as well as invited speakers, it comes up with legislative concepts and policy recommendations to do that. My earlier response regarding the Universal Service Fund, again, I was limiting my response to Senate Bill 13 and Senate Bill 15. I believe you are correct. If we now look at Senate Bill 17, which would be essentially a wholesale examination of telecommunications policy and statutes in Oregon, that well may include a new view or different recommended approach to use of the Oregon Universal Service Fund. So Senate Bill 17, yes, I would agree with you that that has Universal Service Fund implications. Senate Bill 13 and 15, as currently written, do not.
Thank you. One more follow-up. Maybe the commissioner could answer this question. If, in fact, we take a fund that was dedicated for a purpose, and the USF fund, as my understanding, was dedicated in this wonderful bipartisan work group where everybody came together, except for it was 1713 on the floor, I believe Senator Nelson said, together to form this fund to pay for telecommunications for rural Oregon, for underserved, as the language is written on the bill summary, underserved Oregon telecommunications lines. If, in fact, we broaden the use of that USF fund, I mean, to include, you could include electric fences for wolf watching. I don't care. You could tap into that for whatever purpose you wanted, in theory. If we dilute that fund and its uses down so far, don't we hinder future applications of that to deal with dial tones for rural Oregon? I mean, the money just wouldn't be there. Wouldn't you have to raise those funds? I mean, if you're going to broaden the uses of that to anything beyond dial tones, you're going to have to raise the money somewhere, and the applications of which it's for are going to have a hard time being implemented. Am I crazy? But don't answer that last one.
Mr. Chair, Representative, perhaps I could get to the last question. No.
Yeah. We all know the answer, and that's all right.
I'm very hopeful that the Assembly will not see fit to ask the Commission to have anything to do with wolves. But that aside, your premise is correct. If we extended the use of the USF to broadband, it would take more money to do that. And that, frankly, would be a discussion that I think the legislature needs to have if you're looking at that. Let me put it in context, though. You can't just look at the Oregon U.S. Universal Service Fund without also looking at its counterpart, the federal one. The use of that and the dispersion of telecommunications services is changing. Technology is changing. There is a major discussion going on the national level right now in the federal communications on how we charge for those services. And I think that the only thing we know for pretty well for sure, nothing's for sure, but we think is that that mechanism is going to change within the next year to 2 years. I think that probably will cause us to take another look at how we do the Oregon Universal Service Fund, which in my mind means it would be appropriate for the task force to consider that among other issues as it comes back to the Assembly in 2007 and says we've taken a look at telecommunications policy in Oregon as it fits within the national policy and these are our recommendations. So I don't think there's nothing in the three bills that are on the table that will change the way the USS is used now or in the next 2 years unless the legislature changes something about that.
May I follow up?
Follow up.
With what you said, there's nothing in the three bills that would alter the way that the USF fund is spent currently. The ORTC, is my understanding, currently has a bill in the legislature that would do just that and direct funds from the USF to things other than and fund things like broadband. So, in fact, they are trying to take it up legislatively as we speak. So what you're asking this body to do, so that I understand correctly, is expand the life of a commission three legislative sessions out for the sunset, and expand this commission, and this commission by which advocates for the dilution of the USF fund to things other than dial tones. I mean, effectively, that's what you do if you pass these bills.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
Go ahead, Kathy.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I kind of feel like the invisible member on this panel, but I think it's real important that make an effort to intercede here. One of the things that I think is very, very important to understand is that the consideration and the discussion of the State Universal Service Fund is just that. It's a discussion. There was a bill presented to the Senate side that would have changed the way that the Universal Service Fund would receive money and would also expend monies. That bill is not in play. But to say that the discussion of the fund is over is not. And I think to say that something should not be discussed, something should not be considered, is to behave like an ostrich and stick your head in the sand and say, how do we, in fact, do the best job with the funds that we have? The fact that dial tone is no longer considered the line in the sand for basic service by most people is becoming more and more an issue that the council is looking at and considering. For example, dial tone does not work at all in terms of the delivery of healthcare services using telecommunications. Neither does it work for education or primarily the use of government. So we've got to look at different solutions. The whole idea of expanding broadband to rural and underserved areas does not primarily involve changing the Universal Service Fund. It involves some very careful thinking about how we might incent, how we might look at ways of deploying grant monies, of economic development monies, of private vendors' monies to the best use to make sure that broadband is available to everyone on an equal basis in Oregon. I think that to look strictly at the Universal Service Fund or to say that the council's primary mission is to ramrod Universal Service Fund changes through either the legislature or the PUC is erroneous. And another point I want to make is that the council works very much hand in glove with the PUC. We do not make decisions without first asking the PUC what they think about it, without having some extensive dialogue about the impacts, and without talking to the telcos to see what their considerations are in terms of the impacts. Sometimes we have been very polarized between the council and the telcos, and that's unfortunate. It still does not mean that the dialogue does not need to continue at that ORTCC table. So I would urge you not to get bogged down in this USF issue because it's a very minor, very small piece of what's at stake here. Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy, and I apologize. This is new in trying to manage this process where you have the video conference going. And go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, to get to your point, I first, to be very clear, I believe the council did introduce legislation regarding to broadband, which I believe is Senate Bill 14. I don't think that's on the calendar anywhere. The commission shares your concerns about that. We're not necessarily opposed to the idea that the legislature might want to consider funding sources. In fact, we explored those ourselves as a commission and made recommendations to the governor before the session started. Many states are participating in ensuring that broadband gets out to those rural areas of the state where, frankly, you can't build a business case for it. But technology is changing. I don't think you want to jump to the conclusion of, because the council has suggested there may be a need for a funding stream to help get those services to rural areas, that you want to do away with valuable citizen input. I think, as I said at the start, the council has provided very valuable service to the Public Utility Commission as well as the legislature in bringing ideas forward. Frankly, they're not always accepted, but you get a lot of that in this business. That's how you get ideas moving, is by having someone out there who's provocative and cares a lot about their communities. The last piece is, don't dismiss out of hand that broadband and standard old telephony are separate. The technology is changing rapidly. There is a new technology that you're starting to hear a lot about, you may have, called Voice over the Internet Protocol. It may be the emerging way that most of our voice to telecommunications happens. I would suggest to you that and this is a personal opinion, not necessarily the commission's, now is not the time for the legislature to jump into that game and do anything about that. But I think you do want to have the best advice you can in the next couple of years to get that, and I think 17 gets you there. And I think the council, again, is a valuable support for that. We don't, frankly, the commission doesn't always agree with them. We have strong disagreements at times, but it's good to have someone challenge your thinking, and that role is there.
Mr. Chair, my final follow-up. My colleagues on both sides will beat me up if I say anything more than my final.
Finals.
As for the chair,
if the chair would indulge me on one final clarification, as I've had the testifier who interrupted me speak her mind, and then the commissioner testified, I would just say I'm not suggesting that these folks are trying to ramrod anything. First and foremost, I have two concerns. One is the sunset being out so long, three legislative sessions. The second concern that I have is that you have a fund that was set up for a specific purpose, and you're expanding that use. And I don't think anything infuriates Oregonians more than that. I mean, we had, as an example, we had the Secretary of State raising fees all over the place to fill budget gaps for a one-time thing. We heard that earlier in the session. And I provided documentation for this committee on how outraged my constituents were at that sort of an action. It's when you say you're going to do something in this body, and you're doing it for a reason, and you change that reason after the body or the people have accepted the reason, the premise by which you decided to do it. Those are my concerns. So I don't impugn the motives of the people on this commission. I think they're volunteering their time. I support them being able to be reimbursed per diem for their expenses. I'm fine with that. Those are my only two concerns. So I hope not to allude anything to the testifier of ramrodding anything through here.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, things change. We have to be flexible. We have to adapt. There's a bill on the floor today or tomorrow dealing with our transportation money and that we gather to fix bridges, and there may be some left over, and we're going to want to take advantage of that and do some projects around the state that's going to help the community. Do I feel comfortable doing it that way? I don't. I do share your discomfort, and I know the people of Oregon do. But at least we're keeping it within telecom. What I will definitely oppose, if anybody comes in here and wants to control wolves by imposing a tax on rural cell phones, I will definitely be opposed to that. But I think the conversation on where this money comes from, to be fair, I agree with Representative Kitts that we do have to find a funding source that goes to this eventually somehow, and not say we're collecting it for A and spending it B. I know we can't always do that. I understand we need to be flexible and adapting, but I definitely share his concern there. Thank you. And I support all three of these bills too.
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner,
just to be very clear, the Public Utility Commission manages the USF. The statute is very clear that can only be used for telecommunications, not broadband, unless the legislature changes the law. We can't change it. So you may change the law, but we can't.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Beyer, do we have a sense of how much access there is to either DSL or broadband in our rural areas? Or are we talking, you know, 30% of the state rural areas have access, 60? Any sense of that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, boy, you're going to ask me to try and pull it off the top of my head. We did send each of the 90 members of the Assembly a report of a survey we just did. It's, as I recall, we're a little higher than a national average, but Chris, you may be able to help me. I can't recall what the percentage was in rural areas. And again, it depends on how you define that. I would suggest to you that there's a difference if you're talking about inside a city and outside, and where it is. You're actually, if you're using the term DSL, there are large portions of Portland and Eugene where you can't get DSL, but you can get broadband.
My house.
For cable, you know, personally, my broadband in my home is by cable, sort of competitive forces. It's broader than you think. And the other thing, it's a price issue, I should say. You can get broadband to a degree anywhere in the world through satellite, but it's a pricing issue, you know, what it's going to cost you to get that. So,
follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So I just wanted to make a comment that while I appreciate the Representative Kitz's concerns, that if you look at Senate Bill 13, since this is kind of always a moving target, it does seem fair to me that this committee would take a look at broadband services just so that we know, you know, how our rural areas are doing on economic, such a crucial economic development issue.
Chair Brown and Representative Shields, let me offer some information. Again, it's often hard to get your hands around the degree of penetration of the services and availability. I would estimate that about 80% of the Oregon communities have access to DSL, being a type of broadband service technology, a digital subscriber line service provided by local telephone companies. As was alluded to, there are multiple broadband technologies available, including digital subscriber line service from telephone companies, cable modem services from cable TV companies, fixed wireless services from wireless carriers, as well as satellite broadband services. The other variable is that even when DSL service, again, that being the technology provided by the local telephone companies, even when that's available in a wire center and in a community, not necessarily every physical location within served by that wire center is able to receive the service because of the quality of the copper local loop, the distance from the central office, and other factors affect whether or not it's available at a specific address, even if it's the service is available within the community.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. I appreciate this point. We have one more to testify on Senate Bill 17, Jenny Lang.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jenny Lang. I represent Quest Communications, and I'm here to support Senate Bill 17. As Chairman Beyer mentioned, this is sort of a next step bill for the interim coming up. We worked with the commission and industry players on Senate Bill 600 during this past interim, did a lot of basic cleanup, reorganizing of Chapter 759, which relates to telecommunications for Oregon, and now we feel like we're ready to jump into the policy issues that that have been developing over the years. So we are very supportive of this effort and look forward to a very broad-ranging discussion of all of the issues that may relate to technology matters or markets, changes in trends of regulation compared to other states, or what's going on at the federal level. So we're looking forward to this effort and hope that you will support it as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny. Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you for your testimony. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on the Senate Bill 13, 15, and 17 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 983. Kara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 983 comes to you from Senate Rules in conjunction with Senator Walker. It did pass the Senate 29-0. It directs the Public Utilities Commission to adopt rules relating to termination of local exchange residential telephone service that would significantly endanger certain persons. It significantly restrains, uses restraining order or other court order requires that a restraining order must be presented to show that termination of service would endanger a person. It is does carry an emergency clause effective September 1, 2005.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Walker, please. Did you have some people you wanted to bring with you? Thank you for your patience with us.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's been an interesting discussion this morning. I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator from District 7, and I'm just going to take about 30 seconds and then I'll depart so that there are some regular citizens that have come from Eugene and Portland to talk about this bill. Let me just state that this is something I worked on last session, and it had sort of a tortured path through the process. It ended up in Senate Bill 655, Mr. Chair, after everyone finally came to agreement on all of the terms, and it was sitting on the desk on August 27th on the third reading calendar, and we adjourned on the Senate side, and that left it hanging because it needed to come back to the Senate for concurrence.
Senator, that was your fault.
No, Mr. Chair.
Hear, hear.
That was the Senate President's fault. And I went in and begged him and begged him and begged him not to close the Senate down, but he made the decision, and I can't second guess that. He's the Senate President. And so anyway, Mr. Chair, it got hanging like a number of other bills, and so we're back, and it's a very good bill. I could go into detail about it, but we have some really good people here to talk to you about it, so I'd just like to leave it in their hands and get back to a meeting that I have scheduled this morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for allowing me to come here.
Hello, I'm Chair Brown. Thank you for having me and legislators. My name is Cheryl O'Neill, and I am currently the Executive Director at Women's Space in Junction. I live in Junction City. I work in Eugene, Executive Director in Eugene. Thank you very much for your time and attention to this matter. For me, this journey began probably 6 years ago when I was working as an advocate at the Domestic Violence Clinic at Legal Aid in Eugene, and I was working with a woman who had a protective order, and we were trying to get her some phone service. There was an outstanding bill that she and her husband had together, and she had moved into a new place, and she needed to get access. She needed to get a phone so that, you know, her protective order mattered, so that she could call the police if something happened. And both she and I had been speaking with people at the phone company. I spoke speaking with the supervisor, and I was finally told, well, it would be illegal for us to do that. I didn't know where to go with that, and you know, we safety planned together. It was rather difficult because she was new to that location, didn't have any friends or people in the area that she knew. I was going to meet with her again on Monday and see what we could come up with. And so then I got a chance to talk with some of the attorneys there, and they said, oh, no, you know, we should be able to arrange something. And I had this, like, a lot of hope. I'd be able to talk to her on Monday. We'd get this solved. She'd have a phone. And over the weekend, she was brutally raped, and the person, her husband, shot himself in front of her. So it was a really traumatic event. I actually never saw her again. So, I, you know, it was sort of like I had this horrible feeling from that, and that sort of generated a lot of different phone activities for me after that. We did end up setting up a cell phone bank then now in Eugene, because I found out through the process that you could use it for 911 if it didn't have service. We'd gone through a lot of trying to find service for a few phones, and then we finally found out you could use it for 911 without service. And we did get some personal connections in the phone after that. But you know, those changed. The one person I had contact with is now you know, not working there anymore. So we had personal contacts, and we were able to get a few people phones. But there were other incidents where another person that I worked with wasn't able to get enough of a down payment. You know, she didn't have an outstanding bill, but she didn't have quite the full down payment to get the phone. And same thing happened. Had a protective order. A person showed up at her door. I mean, it wasn't quite as brutal, but she was beaten up. Her nose was broken. She had to grab her kids and run to the neighbors to try to, you know, access some help. So I just, you know, I'm like, I'd really like these people to have a phone. And so through a lot of research, we found that kind of, you know, they had the medical certificate where you could, you know, you could say if I had enough of a health risk, you know, I could have access to a phone and be in a payment plan. Because we'd only been asking to be in a payment plan. And we didn't want them to just waive it or anything. And so we were hoping we could just kind of piggyback on that. And we've gone through a lot of process to get here with an actual legislative change because they didn't feel that they could do that on their authority, the PUC. And I just wanted to let you know about the cell phones. Cell phones are great. It's been really wonderful, but they aren't a universal fix for a couple different reasons. As a rural person, thank you for talking about my phone access and everything else. I can't use my cell phone at my home. It takes me about a 6-minute drive or a 6-mile drive, I mean, to get to a place where I can use my cell phone. And, you know, lots of people do live in these kind of rural areas. We are out there. And the other thing is that people need a lot more service when they're trying to rebuild their lives after a violence like that. They need a lot of services besides just 911. If we can make sure that they have access to, you know, a way to find a job. One thing that happened to a person who we were able to get access for, she and her daughter were living in an apartment complex, and she was able to finally get a job and, you know, had the phone, was able to get a job, and her daughter was able to, you know, have a kind of an emergency counseling session with her counselor when her dad had, you know, her dad had chopped up her pet cat, and she'd seen it, and it was kind of really horrific. So she was able to use that phone to call and have an emergency conversation with that counselor. A phone is also, as a service provider, one of our biggest services is our 24-hour hotline, where we have people 24 hours, 7 days a week, available to somebody to call. But if they don't have a phone, you know, they can't call. So we're just really hoping that we can get, you know, this, I think it's pretty reasonable. The person will pay their bill off, you know, the people who entered into the plans that we were able to arrange all paid their bills off, so it worked fine. And they then would actually have that phone in the midst of that crisis. So thank you very much for your time and attention.
Thank you, Cheryl. Just for the rest of you people, I like the bill, and we're short of time, and I'm going to move the bill. So you keep your testimony as brief as possible, and we'll go on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board. You have in front of you Cubs' statements coordinated with Women's Space, and we heartily support the bill. Would welcome your support as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Brown and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Denise Washington. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. And the coalition is a support network that's comprised of programs throughout the state, both in the rural areas and urban areas, who work very hard every day to end violence against women and children in our state. And you heard testimony from my colleague, Ms. O'Neill, very eloquent. I can't add anything to that, and I just appreciate your support and your willingness to move this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Joffrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support the bill, too, but what I want to say is family law, judiciary, all this stuff, I don't know how you guys can deal with this, but thank God you do. I have a little girl, and these little Don Varmints, as long as the old man's around, well, I'll be in jail. But and I wouldn't provide my little girl with a phone. I'd provide her with a gun. Forgive me, but that's this. Thank you for doing what you're doing. I appreciate your being here, and I hope this bill helps you all.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none. Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate you coming very much. Sybil?
Chair Brown and members of the committee, thank you. I'll be very brief. My name is Sybil Hebb. I'm the lobbyist for the Oregon Law Center, which is a civil legal services provider for low-income Oregonians. We prioritize the services to victims of violence, and so victims of domestic violence and sexual assault are very much a priority client base for us, and we just want to offer our support. I have written testimony, and I thank you very much.
Thank you, Sybil. Was there anyone else who'd like to testify on Senate Bill 983? Seeing none, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 9, or public hearing on Senate Bill 983, open the work session. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate Bill 983 to the floor to be passed. Recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 983 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll.
Representative Kitts. Aye, I'm sorry.
Representative
Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative
Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Escobar.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Representative
Foley.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Do we need a carrier?
How about yes. Brzezinski?
We'll see that. Get over here.
Representative Shields, would you carry the bill for us?
I'm delighted.
Suspend the rules so I can go, please.
Okay. Representative Shields.
Chair Brown, I'd also ask that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Shuffler to vote on Senate Bills 119 and 353.
119. Representative Shields has asked for the suspension of the rules to allow for Representative Shoffler to vote on Senate Bill 119 and Senate Bill 386.
353.
Okay, going the wrong way. Senate Bill 353. Is there any objection? Seeing none, Representative Shoffler, how do you vote on Senate Bill 353?
Aye.
And on Senate Bill 119.
Aye. You're an aye on that?
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, sir.
Let's see. Going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 600. Kara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 600A engrossed is before you. It's a bill that simply reorganizes and restates sections of OIS Chapter 759 that deal with telecommunications regulations. The bill came from conversation with telecommunications industry stakeholders in a group organized by the Public Utilities Commission to look at current regulations and laws to determine whether changes were needed to correct obsolete statutes and inconsistent terminology. It was found that this was needed, and that's how the bill came before you today. There are very simple amendments in your packet. You can grab that page. One line is changed from an or to an and another line is changed from an or to an and. So very simple pieces, and there are members of the telecommunications industry to speak to you on the bill today.
Thank you, Kara. Shelley Jensen and Lee Beyer, please. Is Lee still there? Yeah, he's still here. And Commissioner Beyer, I want to know if you're going to mess around with that fund that
No, Mr. Chairman.
For the record, he took me out to the hall, took me to the woodshed, and
Well, thank you, Commissioner. You've got something arrested that I've been able to handle.
He said, boy, let me tell you what.
Shelley, you want to start?
Sure. Good morning, Chairman Brown and committee members. I'm Shelley Jensen, Regulatory and Governmental Affairs Manager for Verizon. As the committee administrator explained, this was a bill that was developed over the interim by all members of the telecommunications industry that are regulated by the PUC, AT&T, Qwest, Sprint, CUB, the OTA, Integra, and the Public Utilities Commission were all involved in the work group developing this. It makes no substantive changes in the law. It simply reorganizes the section that deals with telecommunications so that things are easier to find and that things that relate to each other are in the same section. And it also did eliminate some obsolete things. For example, on page 2, line 32, it takes out of the definition of toll that charges are made on a per unit basis, because a lot of companies now you pay a flat fee for unlimited toll service. So a few things like that were eliminated, but basically it doesn't make any changes. It just reorganizes. And the amendments are to put those two sections back to the way the existing law is, in making some of the changes. Ledge Council inadvertently changed a couple of ands to ors, and so they need to get changed back.
Thank you, Shelley. Commissioner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Lee Beyer, Chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. Mr. Chair, members, this is the way you like to see legislation come to you.
Yes.
It's been all worked out beforehand, and there's nothing controversial here. I would like to just be on record very clearly that the Commission wholeheartedly supports this, and more importantly, I want to extend my thanks to the members of the industry and the consumer groups that have worked with us, and particularly from our side to Phil Nygaard, who's back here in the audience, who is the administrator of our telecommunications section and worked hard to get this all organized in a way that we could get it to you. It's good. It's good legislation. It clarifies things. It makes it easier for members of the public who are interested in telecommunications, as well as us in administering it, to administer the law. Not touch any policies. That was an agreement we started out. It was just to make it easier to use and not do the policies, set those off for the interim. So I think you should have no problem supporting this and feeling good about it.
Thank you, Commissioner. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, folks.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 600? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 600 and open the work session on Senate Bill 600. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move the dash two amendments into Senate Bill 600.
Representative Kitts moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 600. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered. Representative Kitts.
I move Senate Bill 600 as amended to the floor.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 600 as amended to the floor.
Do pass recommendation.
With a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 600 as amended to the consent calendar.
Being that the thickness of it, you don't think we need a recommendation or just a clarification?
Mr. Chair, I'm at the chair's disposal. I will withdraw my motion if you see fit.
What does the committee think? Consent calendar or not?
My scanning of it, it's a technical fix and reverting things back to the way they once were. If we need to explain that to our colleagues on the floor, I'm more than happy to. If not,
thank you, Representative. Representative Shields is volunteering you as to carry it on the next one. Thank you, Representative.
I'm more than happy.
I want to open the work session on Senate Bill 13.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I might, I understand that these bills are very important to my colleague in the Senate. And he is not here. I had an idea that I wanted to run by him. I would move to postpone these to a date certain, and a date certain being the next time the committee meets, to take up these three bills for the purpose of a work session immediately at that time, if that's agreeable to the chair, and see if Senator Nelson will address my concerns that I have. I think it's a very simple fix, but it would just take a day to talk with him.
The chair is willing to do that. So we have a motion then.
Friday?
Well, I'll just close the work session and the bills will be. So we have to post them, be able to post them.
I simply need you to state that it's your intent to work the bills on Friday.
Okay, it's the intent of the chairman to work the bills on Friday then. And so we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 13. And let's see, did we get the other 982, 983? Yeah, I think they're all done. They're out of here.
So, am I carrying that bill or is it on the consent calendar for clarity?
No, you're carrying the bill.
What I meant was, am I carrying that bill or is it on the consent calendar? Maybe you didn't understand my question.
Okay, and with that, we are adjourned. And